Fangoria has been at it for over 40 years and is better than ever. This magazine, it's not only gorgeous, it's highly collectible and delivered right to your door 4 times a year. Each issue filled to the brim with articles exploring every nook and cranny of genre filmmaking, past, present, and future, with all the most exciting journalists, filmmakers, and horror know-it-alls to guide the way, including little old me from time to time. This high-quality writing will only ever appear within the physical pages of the magazine, never online, so if you want to join in on the fun, you're going to need to subscribe, and in order to do that, all you got to do is head on over to Fangoria.com and sign up. If you use the code KINGCAST at checkout, you will save an astronomical 25% off of your subscription. That's Fangoria.com, code KINGCAST. Now on with the show.
Hi. My name is Stephen King.
He's gonna break!
Bedroom!
Bedroom! You guys wanna go see a dead body?
Well, sometimes that is better.
Welcome back to the KINGCAST on the Fangoria Podcast Network. I am Anthony Bresnikan.
And I'm Eric Vespi.
And we're your hosts on this podcast about creative people and their connection to Stephen King. We have a very special guest today. I'm super excited to have him on the show. Eric, this first, I think we should set this up a little bit. We just did a special Patreon episode. We were talking about a lot of different Stephen King news. And one of the things that we chatted about there was that Hasbro announced a new character in its G.I. Joe Classified series, sort of a collectible toy series. This would be Crystal Ball, the Cobra hypnotist, propagandist, occult expert who wielded a holographic shield that was capable of mind control. This was interesting to the KINGCAST because the character was created by Stephen King and his son, Owen King, back in the mid-80s. And Eric, that was news to you, right? You know a lot about Stephen King, but that was...
It absolutely was. This was something that I had... I was born in 81. So of course, you know, the era of, you know, G.I. Joe's dominance, was ripe. I had plenty of those toys and whatnot, but I never in a million years. And I remembered this figure. I remember when you mentioned the holographic shield, I was like, oh my God, like I probably own that. And I had no idea that Stephen King was associated with it in any way.
I didn't know about it either until I interviewed King and Owen King when they wrote the novel Sleeping Beauties a few years ago. They discussed this as one of their little early collaborations. Father and son teamed up on creating a G.I. Joe character and sending it in to Hasbro. And I wanted to find someone who could talk about that. And after fishing around a little bit, I thought I'd take a chance and reach out to the undisputed master behind G.I. Joe. A writer and illustrator, an absolute comics legend, the wonderful storyteller, Larry Hama. Larry, thanks for being on the KINGCAST today.
Well, thanks for having me.
You're probably best known for G.I. Joe, A Real American Hero, but you've also made your mark on Iron Fist and Wolverine. You wrote some of the early Star Wars comics, among many others, a very long and acclaimed career. You're in the Eisner Hall of Fame, and as I understand it, you correct me if I have anything wrong here, Larry, but you've been drawing and telling stories ever since you were a kid. Is that right?
I sold my first cartoon to Castle of Frankenstein magazine in 1966.
And how old were you then?
I was in high school. I was 16 or 17, something like that.
And after high school, you joined the Army. You were in the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. I think it was the 18th Engineer Brigade. Is that right?
Well, no. After I graduated high school, I worked in underground comics in New York. I was in Gothic Blimp Works, which was... the Sunday Funnies at the East Village Other. It was originated by Vaughn Bodie, who was the original editor and art director. But he got taken over by Trina Robbins and Kim Deitch. And other creators that were in that publication were Art Crumb, Art Spiegelman, Spain Rodriguez, Jay Lynch, Mike Kaluta, Bernie Wrightson, Justin Green, pretty much everybody that started underground comics in New York before they all moved to San Francisco. And also three, young guys who were trying to break into mainstream comics but couldn't get in the door, which is me, Kaluta, and Wrightson. And I was also working for, I had a regular job at an art studio that did all the Sears Roebuck Montgomery Ward JCPenney catalogs.
paying the bills with.
So you were drawing, you were creating like images for the catalogs and things like that of the products.
I was drawing shoes. I was in a room with two other guys who were much older. Had been there for 30 years, all just drawing shoes in this tiny little room at a huge, like if you can imagine the Sears Roebuck Montgomery Ward and JCPenney catalogs for a whole year stacked up. That's like the equivalent of six old Manhattan's phone books.
Right. It's a lot of shoes.
Of shoes. Well, it's a career track.
Not just shoes, but there was like, they handled everything. There's one guy in the on the photography floor who only did tool kits. When you see tool kits advertised, it's a 188 piece socket set, and they've got them all arranged. It's an incredible pattern. Well, this was the guy that did that. And if you can appreciate how hard it is to light and photograph like that many shiny objects.
All right. It's a hell of a speciality, by the way. It's like, I'm the toolbox guy. You want more? You got a 1,000-piece set? You can only come to one guy.
What's better was that the room next door to ours was the brassiere and girdle guys. and they retouched all the black and white photos of brassieres and girdles and put in every single stitch. So if you look at the brassiere and girdle sections of those old catalogs, it's like
I would very never detailed. Larry. I would never
it's like the most clear depiction of that stuff you could ever imagine. and those guys were, they'd been in there for 30 years doing nothing but putting the stitches on brassieres and girdles.
Wow. Incredible. What a life's work.
I got drafted out of that. So then when I came back out of the Army, a high school buddy of mine, Ralph Reese, who was a pretty well-known comic illustrator at the time, and I'd gone to art school with him, high school of art design. And he said, you should come and start a studio with me because you can pencil faster than I can pencil. And I can ink faster than you can ink. So between the two of us, we might be able to make a deadline.
So I jumped over your catalog work there, but it's right. You were in the 18th Engineer Brigade, right? Of the Army Corps of Engineers?
No.
No? Oh. Okay.
I was usually in headquarters units, but I wasn't in the Corps of Engineers.
Got it.
That's a different thing altogether. I was in the engineer branch of the U.S. Army.
It's really but interesting, anyway, not to make this about Stephen King right off the bat, but it's really funny because King was he had a low draft number too, and he got called in, but he didn't pass his physical, and so he didn't go in. His eyes were too shitty, apparently. So,
by the way,
I didn't pass the first two physicals.
Wow, and they still forced you into the war.
Right after the Tet Offensive, they just started taking everybody.
Oh. Wow,
and when I went in for the physical, they just lined everybody up and said, "Everybody, roll up your sleeves." And a guy with a lab coat came down, looked at everybody's arms, and said, "Okay, no track marks. You're all going in."
No,
and that's what happened. And then Oh, there was a, you know, one guy raised his hand and he said, you know, I have a note from my doctor that says I wet the bed. And the DI just said, oh, it's okay. We got rubber sheets. And then another guy comes in with a clipboard and he says, okay, everybody sound off 1 to 4. And, you know, and I'm number two, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4. And then he says, okay, all number three, step forward. The guy next to me steps forward, you know, and all the other three step forward. And the guy with the clipboard says, okay, all number threes aren't going in the army today. And all the ones and the twos and the fours, oh man.
Oh no. Wow.
And all the number threes are doing like the happy dance.
Oh my gosh.
The guy flips a page over on his clipboard and says, okay, we have to meet our quota for the Marine Corps today. So every fourth guy that day was shipped down to Parris Island.
Wow, jeez. Incredible.
But anyway, yeah, let's get back on the Stephen King.
Yeah, well, I feel like I should explain. I got that 18th Engineer Brigade from the VA. VA.gov has a bio of you. You were named their Veteran of the Day back in
Oh,
2018.
right. Yeah, well, that's true in a way, but you know, I never saw myself functioning in that capacity.
I see.
I was always attached to engineer command
Got it.
headquarters companies.
They described you as a firearms and explosive ordnance expert. Is that accurate?
Yeah, sort of. I mean,
And that you would.
I qualified expert on M14 and M16 and some other things.
And
Uh,
that.
and
And that.
then I actually had to go to the PX and buy the badge because, you know, the badge they give you is this like crappy pot metal thing. And for I think it was $10, which was a lot of money in 19,
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
70. You could buy a sterling silver one, so that's what
Wow.
I had.
Oh, nice.
So the VA said you would work with combat engineers and infantrymen, and you'd go in to destroy enemy tunnels, and that you were in the service for about 4 years. Is all that, does that sync up?
Not all of it, but there's some aspects of all that that I really can't talk about.
Oh,
So,
okay. All right. Well,
okay.
that's what the VA says. That's it. The
Yeah.
VA is giving you
Okay.
those that
Well,
credit.
you know, the VA, you know, they're their thing, you know,
I
but
gotcha.
they've got their limitations too.
Right.
And then, you know, it all ties into the fact that in the mid-70s there was this suspicious fire at Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, where all the army records were kept. And in those days, it was like 80% paper.
Yeah.
You know, there was before everything was computerized. A huge amount of records that overlapped onto areas that were kind of dicey, you know, just went up in flames.
Well, I love that
Anyway.
the creative force behind G.I. Joe has a classified section to his bio. So we'll just leave that. We'll leave that under wraps. But my understanding is, you
Yeah, I
know, that
mean,
you're.
I don't really want to go more into it because I
Yeah.
was told on release by a bird colonel that everything I don't deny, I should forget.
All right. There you go. Well, I bring it
That's
up.
the Vietnam War in a nutshell, Larry.
Okay.
I bring it
Yeah.
up, Larry,
Okay.
not to expose you, but to say you served in the military. You brought that service to bear in your creative work. Is that fair to say that you also studied martial arts, as I understand it, or interested in Eastern philosophy, and all of these found their way into G.I. Joe. Is that right?
You know,
Yeah.
I've done, I never, you know, if I had, I always said if I had any ambition, I would have been dangerous. But I never had a game plan. You know, I told Ralph, you know, I sought a studio with him because I didn't know what I was going to do. You know, I didn't want to go back to drawing shoes. So, but I thought, well, comics might be a good thing to do for a couple of years before I find my real path. And, you know, 50 years later, I woke up and I was still doing comics. So you never know.
Well, all of us nerds are very grateful that that you stayed on that path. Before we dive into your actual collaboration with him, can you tell me what your Stephen King origin story is? Like, what's the first time you heard about Stephen King? Was this like a book? Was it a movie?
I worked in Neil Adams' continuity graphic studio, which is on 48th Street off Fifth Avenue.
Yeah.
And the Scribner's, the original big Scribner's bookstore was literally around the corner. Mm-hmm. So I would stop in there all the time. You know, they had a huge, wonderful selection. And one day I saw on the paperback rack this shiny black embossed cover of Salem's Lot.
With the one red dot?
With the one red
dot. Yeah.
And the face embossed.
Yeah.
You know, and I thought, wow, what a killer cover.
Mm.
And that's why I picked it up the rack and I read the blurb on the back. And I thought, oh. So I took it home and started to read it. And I distinctly remember, you know, getting to the, you know, I was at home like 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, in bed reading.
The you Stephen know, King page turner got you right from the first paperback. Yeah.
Yeah. And I come to that whole scene where the kid is in his bedroom and mm-hmm. this other kid is rapping at his window mm-hmm. saying, "Let me in." And then the kid realizes his bedroom is on the second floor. What is this kid standing on? And that raised the hackles on the back. And I remember just, you know, glancing up at my own bedroom window. Yeah.
And for a split second, you saw a little embossed face with a one red drip. Yeah,
you know, I was on the 13th floor. You know,
That would have been really freaky. That was my cover too. That was the Salem's Lot cover. A lot of the early King that I read was on my mom's bookshelf. Like, my mom was a big King reader, and that was her copy that I read, was that paperback. I remember.
Well, they always had really good paperback covers.
Yeah,
so, you know, one about the car.
Oh yeah, Christine.
Christine.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the one about the rabbit dog.
Yep. Yeah, that's another one that's burned into my mind because it's just Cujo's snout. Yeah. It's just his snout with like the drool dripping dripping off of it. Yeah, no, that was my first Stephen King I read, was that paperback, and I remember hiding it
very
in my school lunchbox.
Scored really good artists.
Yes. Well, sorry to talk over you, man, but that's exactly like one of the great things about King's work is that he, from the very beginning, some of it must be luck with in the early days. I'm sure he wasn't commanding who was doing his dust jacket covers and all that. But like early on in his career, he partnered with artists, you know, like whether it was Michael Whalen for the Gunslinger in the early 80s, or Bernie Wrightson, as we talked about, for you know, Cycle of the Werewolf, and you know, and
Frankenstein.
Oh my God, yeah, Wrightson's Frankenstein work is legendary. I've seen some
indelible,
of those pages up close. They're unbelievable. Mm-hmm. As gorgeous as they look, you know, printed, it's next level seeing the original.
Oh, yeah.
And in Guillermo del Toro's upcoming Frankenstein movie, you're going to see a lot of the Wrightson influence because he's
a major fan.
It's interesting to me, Larry, that you would, you know, obviously as an artist yourself, you would be drawn first to the imagery and then to the story. Continue?
That's why I bought most of the paperbacks that I bought. I bought them for the covers. You know, I mean, that's what, I mean, I wouldn't, you know, like Conan, you know, those Frazetta covers.
Oh, God, I love those, yeah.
And the earlier Edgar Rice Burroughs books with covers by
the Tarsoom books, Frankel, right?
And those guys, you know, I mean, geez. And then there was Bama, you know, who did like the Doc Strange covers, you know, with the torn shirt.
It's an era that I really miss.
Lost art.
Yeah, I mean, I gotta say, because I collect movie posters and movie you know, pretty much all movie stuff, like, you know, in the back there, that's an original Tom Young painting for a Burt Reynolds movie called White Lightning. You know, it's like I adore that, you know, that era where, like, that it was illustration. That was what caught the eye, you know, it wasn't
a golden age, but it wasn't, you know, there's no more of that. It's all photographs now.
Yeah. I mean, we had, I guess, a little bit of a resurgence with the pop culture poster, you know, thing that happened where, you know, with Mondo and whatnot, but like even that's kind of fizzled out now. Yeah. And now we're entering an AI era, which is making me nostalgic for Photoshop, which I never in a million years thought I would say. But
well, AI I think has its place, but yeah. You know, when it really falls short when they try to make stuff look human.
Right.
There's no, you could really sense the robotic origins of it all, because it's like, you know, they don't understand emotions,
right,
or you know what triggers emotions.
Well, that's a great point, and I'm thinking as you're talking here about those cards that would be on the G.I. Joe toys that would have an image of the character.
The file cards. Yeah.
Well, they're the file cards on the back that have a little bit of bio. And it reminds me a little bit of a book, essentially, is you've got the cover, the striking image of the Flint or Snake Eyes or Storm Shadow striking a pose. On the back, you have the blurb, the little summary. It's like the inside flap of a book that describes what's there. And the novel itself is the character. You can take the character and make your story with, if you're a kid who is so inclined. And what was your relationship to the toys? I know you wrote all these comics. You wrote, I think it was like 155 comics in that first run from 82 to 94. What was the give and take like with Hasbro? Because they had the G.I. Joe line. Originally, it was the tall figures, the sort of Barbie-sized dolls back in the 60s. And then they came up with this idea to create essentially like a superhero team, where every member of the military, of this special branch of the military, had a speciality, had a specific skill that, and then you could mix and match the teammates and create different stories. So how did that give and take happen? Would they say, we need this type of character, we need that type, and then you would devise it? Were you coming up with the characters and then the toy maker would?
No. They would come up with the toy.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, when Hasbro came to Marvel, they gave Marvel carte blanche. They said, like, you know, we know how to make toys, but we don't know how to make comics. You know, you don't know how to make toys, but you know how to make comics. So, you know, come up with what you think is best. Everybody else turned it down, all the writers and creators and whatnot, because on a licensed property, the licensing fee came off the top of the page rate. So people were paid less to work on the toy license books. Ergo, no A-list writer or artist in their right mind would want to work on something that would, you know, pay them less money.
Right.
Especially, you know, when there were no royalties involved.
It was all work for hire, in other words.
It was all work for hire. But I had been trying to get my foot in the door writing for 10 years at that point, you know, but no editor would give me work, saying, well, you know, you're an artist, you can't write. And so this is because all the editors were writers.
Gatekeeping, huh?
Well, they didn't want artists to start writing their own stuff. They would be spitting in their own wallets. So I was the last person to ask, and I said I'd do it, you know. And I've said this a thousand times in 100 different interviews. That if they had offered me Barbie, I would have taken Barbie. I just had no interest in, you know, doing a military comic. I had tried to get into the comic business because I wanted to do funny animals. I was a huge Karl Barks fan. And I've always said that, you know, G.I. Joe is just the junior woodchucks with guns.
Well, that's probably why it appealed so much to kids, though, in, you know, especially that era. I mean, I know that it's maybe militarism isn't in vogue right now with a lot of the youth, but, you know,
but that wasn't the point.
Yeah,
wasn't,
but
you know, it's not military stuff. Is not the core fantasy that drives G.I. Joe. The core fantasy is loyalty and camaraderie,
right?
And a sense of justice being done, you know, and the fact that all the characters, you know, are treated equally, which is why a lot of girls started liking the book.
Right.
Years later, I discovered that, you know, when they did the research, they found that if there's five kids in a family and reading material for kids came into the household, every one of the siblings read it.
Wow.
You know, yeah. I mean, and I realized, yeah, like what I would read all my cousins' girl comics.
Mm.
You know, my girl cousins had Archies and mm-hmm. Little Lulus and, you know, Harvey comics.
Mm-hmm.
And if I was at their house, you know, there was always a stack of comics. I'd read those, you know.
Yeah.
And they would read my comics. Mm-hmm. So, and each one of these girls that approaches me at a con says that, you know, that's the reason they started reading the book. Is that like they would just offhandedly, you know, read one of their brother's G.I. Joe comics and realize, mm-hmm. oh, the girls in this book aren't constantly taking showers in the X Mansion.
You have some great female characters in this. Lady J, Scarlet, Cover Girl was very cool. The Baroness is an awesome character.
Well, I created the Baroness from the ground up because
yeah?
In the very first issue, I was starting to put it on its feet, and I realized there was not a single character with his face open.
Right.
Among the Cobras? Yeah.
Yeah, among the Cobras. Everybody had...
had a mask.
Totally faceless.
Yeah. And
well, how do you do dramaturgy without agents of expression?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, you just have like, it's like having like chess pawns standing there, like, you know, with mm-hmm. balloon bubbles.
Right.
So I said to her, Trippy, let's make a female character. And while we're at it, let's make her a hot babe in a complete tight black leather suit.
I don't know why you thought young boys would be interested in reading that.
Well, see, that was the thing. You know, the general knowledge within the toy industry at that time was that a boy wouldn't buy a female action figure because that wouldn't be an action figure. That would be
a doll.
Mm, and no 10-year-old boy wanted to be caught dead buying a doll. But I said, you know, if we make this look good enough, mm-hmm. you know, and Hasbro saw the potential in that, and they created the Baroness figure, and it sold through the roof.
Mm.
You know, and that's when they decided, oh, it's okay to have female action figures.
And Scarlet was like in Lady J, they were members of the team. They weren't given less to do, or they weren't like the secretary. They weren't Miss Moneypenny or something like that. They were fearsome. I still remember Scarlet and her crossbow. And I understand that you would base your characters around people you knew. Is it true that your wife was an inspiration for Scarlet? Or is that just
an internet
rumor?
Character-wise, I mean, the thing is, I needed to nail characters,
mm-hmm.
you know, their motivations, their, you know, their peccadilloes, whatever. So I decided the best way to do that was to base characters, you know, on people I knew.
Mm-hmm.
Character, not the fact that there would be an expert with like an M16.
Yeah, right. Your wife's not a crossbow expert?
No.
But personality-wise, you're saying?
Personality-wise, yeah.
So you would cast people you knew as the characters.
Yeah,
essentially.
Yeah, because that way I could keep the characters really consistent.
Yes, yeah.
I mean, I would sometimes, and it helped in the writing. I would get to a point. There's some forms of writing that I really don't care for, which is, you know, what I call choreography, where people are just moving characters around on a board. You know, And they're moving those characters to get the plot or the story to a certain point.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to, and getting it to that point becomes more important than the continuity of the characters.
Mm-hmm.
And I objected to that. So I would get to a point in the story where this character, we'd be about to do something, and I go, oh, wait a second. My cousin Randy wouldn't do that.
Right.
And I have to rethink it over and put myself in his shoes and see how it would react. And that leads to a more naturalistic a continuity of character and storytelling.
Who was Cousin Randy in the G.I. Joe pantheon?
I'm not going to tell you.
Randy would try and collect. What was an aspect of your wife that went into Scarlet?
Well, she's very practical, very pragmatic, and very loyal. So, it's really hard to describe in overt terms. Part of it is just little bits that make the character real, that helps. I mean, there's so many characters out there that are just a collection of traits. But if you can make the character really solid from then on, other people can write the character. I mean, anybody can really write Wolverine or Batman or Superman, because we're all ingrained with who these characters are.
Right. They have a distinct personality. Yeah.
They have such a distinct personality and such a well-documented history. And, you just know this instinctually. I remember in the 70s, one said that the three most famous things in the world that everybody in the world recognizes is Superman, Muhammad Ali, and Coca-Cola.
And Superman fought Muhammad Ali. Yeah. So.
Right. You could show a picture of any of those three things. This is like in the 60s and 70s.
Right.
Anybody in the world, whether they were like a hot tot, like an Eskimo or whatever, they would know. They would know what that was.
Right.
That's very rare now.
What you said about how anybody can pick up the character and continue the story, if you have a well-drawn personality behind that character, right, really strikes me, because I think back to being a kid myself and reading the comics, the G.I. Joe comics, and watching the cartoon as well, and the and then you play with your toys. My brother Greg had a lot of the G.I. Joes. I had some of the G.I. Joes. And what I've noticed as a father myself, when my kids are little, kids have a hard time with empathy. They're very self-absorbed. They're not aware of the world. They're not aware of how other people feel. They have to learn that as they get older. And so creating characters is hard for a child. They don't know what it's like to be themselves, let alone to be other people. But if you give them the character, then they can take that team, those villains, and make up their own story, essentially writing the character in their backyard. And I wonder what your thoughts, is that how it works? Do you see it working that way?
Well, that's one aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll tell you, the thing that most fans tell me when they come to see me at a con, a huge amount of them say either one of two things. They say, I had a really crappy childhood. There was a lot of strife in my family. I created a world that they could retreat into that was like safe, that had a real sort of moral center, and where, the characters could depend on each other and were loyal. And, any kid by the time they're 8 years old has been betrayed. So the idea of like this group that supports each other to that extent, the fantasy that no matter what kind of jam you're in, Snake Eyes will come and get you out of it. Mm-hmm. That's a really power fantasy. The other thing that people have told me is that they had dyslexia or had a huge problem reading, and that, you know, their parents gave them the G.I. Joe books, hoping to encourage them reading, and they got hooked.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that was different than having people come up and say, I really like your work.
Yeah, it means something. You know? It means something profound.
Consistent, mellow, and super delicious, Lumi Gummies are specifically designed to make you feel good, not stoned. Whether you're looking for an end-of-the-day distressor, a midday mood boost, or help getting the best sleep ever, Lumi Gummies has a strain that's right for you. They're our longest sponsor, and yes, I am a user of these gummies. In fact, I had one last night to help me get to sleep. I've been very vocal about my constant battle with my dumb old circadian rhythm that loves to just put me on a vampire sleep schedule. And ever since Lumi Labs started sponsoring the show, I've been using them to help me wind down at a semi-human hour. Lumi Gummies are available nationwide. Go to lumigummies.com. That's L-U-M-I gummies.com and use the code KINGCAST for 30% off of your order. Again, that's L-U-M-I gummies.com, code KINGCAST. Now let's get back to the show.
You know, and one of the kids that connected with these stories was Owen King, who was
about 12, I think.
About 12 years old. And he, the story told to me by Owen and Steve themselves is that Steve encouraged him, well, come up with your own character. And who would you put on this team? And they wrote up an idea and sent it through to Hasbro. It's been a long time, so they were a little fuzzy on like who they sent it to or how they got it there. But do you know?
I think they sent it to Kurt Bazigian or Bob Prubis. They were the ones that were in charge of the line.
Like at Hasbro? Were those Hasbro executives?
At Hasbro, yeah. So and they said, oh, this is great. It's great publicity, too. And so the character was presented to me as a fait accompli, you know. And at first I was a little chuffed. I said, you know, I thought I was supposed to write all of these things.
Yeah, you're honing in on my business, Steve.
So this didn't happen all the time. I'm sure there are lots of kids who wrote it.
It didn't happen all the time. This was very rare. And I didn't know what to do with the character. I mean, you know, he's just like, he's got a hypno wheel. He's got this outlandish outfit. And his powers were like really bizarre. And then years later, it came to me in a flash because I couldn't figure out how to moor his character in reality. Mm-hmm. I didn't know anybody that I could, you know, base the characterization on. And then I realized, oh, wait a second. He has a storefront in a rundown strip mall in northern New Jersey. You know, with a neon sign that says spiritualist or
like a palm reader type.
He's got this like palm reader parlor in some rundown strip mall where half the shops are closed, and like he's between a nail salon and a pizzeria. That's when I realized who this character was, you know, and what I could do with him. You know, and then I started to use them all the time.
You're like, because, wait a minute, maybe this Stephen King guy might have come up with an interesting character.
So the file card on the back of the crystal ball toy, there's a rumor online that you wrote this, but you said no.
No, I didn't write it.
That's Owen
wrote it. Yeah.
And this background is born of a Romanian father who supposedly had second sight and an American mother from Bangor, Maine. So there's your first clue. That it's
exactly.
He was actually the seventh son.
You know, that great dating site, Romanian/ Mainers, lobster vampires. I don't know what you would call that dating site.
But have you ever been to Bangor, Maine?
I have, a couple of times. It was beautiful. I went the first time and I was just so enamored by the Stephen Kinginess of it all. And then I went the second time and I'm like, oh man, I love it so much. I was looking at houses and so I'm like, I could move here. Like, I love this.
You know, he used that airport in a couple of his books too.
Langoliers famously. And when I went the second time, I'm like, oh yeah, this is a really boring small town. Yeah, and I spent like 3 or 4 days there, and I'm like, oh man, I'd go crazy if I lived here.
I think the airport has like two gates.
It's a small place, and I have really a lot of affection. Tiny. I have a lot of affection for that city, but yeah, no, I've been to Bangor. It's hilarious. Sorry, Anthony.
That's okay. So in this book, Dan Klingensmith has done a series of books documenting the creation of G.I. Joe.
And his books are terrific. Yeah.
They're really wonderful. He has some early drawings. Like, I guess these are concept drawings. It looks like there's a fellow named Ron Rudet. Is that right?
Ron Rudet.
Yeah. Rudet.
Ron Rudet. Pretty much designed all the G.I. Joe characters right from the get-go.
So he would design the toy, send the imagery to you. You would then create the character.
He would make these production drawings.
Mm-hmm.
And the first year, they were in black and white.
Mm-hmm.
They were just black and white drawings. And they were labeled things like infantry guy. Mortar guy,
or right?
Espionage, so just these very vague job titles,
mm-hmm.
and that's all they had. I had to come up with who they were and where they were from, and in order to facilitate that, because I realized it was 10 Joe characters and more Cobra characters going to be every year, and I thought, well, that's more than the Avengers, and I remembered that all the people that worked on Avengers and what we call group books were always complaining, there's too many characters to keep track of, and you got to remember all the details on the costumes and uniforms, and it's just so much research involved.
Mm-hmm.
People complained about those books as much as they complained about working on Spider-Man, because nobody could seem to remember which way the arcs on the webbing faced.
Right. I've seen McFarlane have very strong opinions on which way they face and how people get it wrong. So
yeah, I mean, it's like nobody could seem to ever remember. So they had to like constantly look it up.
Right.
So I decided I was going to make these what I call dossiers that were a couple of pages long on each of these characters, so that I would have a blueprint for myself, so I couldn't stray from that. And my original ones were 2 to 3 pages long. They included a peer assessment profile, written in the voice of another Joe, and a psychological profile written by a fake shrink. And they were much more detailed. And one day, Kurt Bazigian was at my office, and he saw these on my desktop. And he said, "Well, what are those?" I said, "Well, that's how I keep track of the characters." And he looked at them and he said, "Oh, we should put these on the back of the packages."
Right.
And that was how that started. That was the first time that was ever done. It's become an industry standard.
Yeah.
It's crucial for everything Anthony was just talking about and giving the kids the background, because maybe not every kid that picked up a G.I. Joe or a Ninja Turtle or a He-Man or figure or whatever in my era watched the cartoon or read the comics or whatever the other material was. Sometimes they just saw something that looked cool on the shelf. And then you have that background. And then, like Anthony said, that's the seed that then grows the playtime, the imagination,
Well, the other thing was that the salespeople at Hasbro, the people that had, who wore polyester leisure suits and, traveled around the country selling the product to KB's and Toys R Us and stuff, people like that. They said, "Send us more of those file cards, because that's all we have to do is to make a sale, is to read the back of the package to the buyer, the toy stores." And then after the Dreadnoks came out, I was sitting at home watching David Letterman. And this was before Jay Leno was mm-hmm. was a host. He was his comedian guest.
Mm-hmm. Right.
He comes on the David Letterman show and he's got a stack of Dreadnoughts figures. You know, and he based his whole little routine on how, you know, the Dreadnoughts were terrible. They were giving motorcyclists a bad rep and stuff. And then he would like hold up each one and read the backs.
You mentioned being a little like chagrined that you got this sort of order to just add this character to the line. But was that blow softened at all by the fact that it came from King and his son? That you were like, oh, that's kind of cool collaboration then.
Yeah, I thought it was cool. You know, especially since, you know, I really liked Stephen King's work. You know?
Yeah.
I pretty much read everything he's ever written.
Did you have any communication with them back then, or was it all through letters? Like,
I had no communication with them at all. All mm-hmm. the communication between the Kings was with Hasbro.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever met him or talked to him since, no. or Owen?
Never met either of them.
I remember Owen
not
when
not
we talked.
Not even when I was in Bangor.
You know, I remember.
I was at a small con in Bangor,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they had the misfortune of scheduling it on the same day as the whole concert, you know.
Oh.
And, and every hotel room in Bangor was already signed up for.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the attendance at this con was like so dismal that after noon on the first day, all the wrestlers who were guests came over to my table and asked me if I wanted to go over and beat up the promoters.
Well, at some point you'll cross paths with Owen. He's a comic book writer himself now. He has a series out called Self Help. It's like a crime saga. Almost, it reminds me a little of like an Elmore Leonard style crime story about a guy who assumes the identity of a famous self-improvement guru, but there's gangsters and murder and terrible things that happen. And he's an author himself now. He wrote Double Feature and The Curator. Yeah. He had a great graphic novel called Intro to Alien Invasion. It's very satiric about a college campus that gets overtaken by aliens and the aliens absorb the kind of preoccupations of the college kids. So he grew up to be a storyteller in his own right. And I think it all started with Crystal Ball. And, he was a little chagrined about it. He was a little, we talked about it back when Sleeping Beauties came out, because he said, you know, I don't think the G.I. Joe fans really liked Crystal Ball. He was sort of a peg warmer toy. But I love now that Hasbro is putting it out again and reissuing it. And they're now revealing his code name is Crystal Ball, but he's named Richard King, which I assume must be some throwback to either Richard Bachman and a combination of Stephen King.
Right.
But there was another character called Sneak Peek, a G.I. Joe character who's real. He was one of the good guys. I believe he was like a communications expert of some sort. And his name was Owen King from Bangor, Maine. Now, did you create that character? Was that just a little shout out to the kid who'd,
exactly.
But loved he was your
a,
work?
The character was a surveillance.
Surveillance.
That's why he's called Sneak Peek.
Mm-hmm. You yourself became a G.I. Joe character. Is that right? That there was a Tunnel Rat character?
Well, physically, I became mm-hmm. that. They just used my... they sent a sculptor to my office. They hired this guy who did all the hologram sculptures mm-hmm. for credit cards. He was the guy that did the original Dove for the Visa card.
Mm-hmm.
It's still being used.
Right.
You know, and that was because holograms, the sculpture has to be the same size as it's reproduced at.
Mm-hmm.
So he was a perfect guy to be able to get a lot of detail into a tiny little head. So he came to the office and took a lot of Polaroids and made some sketches. And then they put my head on the Tunnel Rat figure. But, you know, by the time... You know, this little lump of plastic. And in those days, the molding process wasn't as advanced.
Mm-hmm.
So they were, you know, they were fairly amorphous blobs.
Yeah.
with a paint job on them. And you know, you can see how amorphous they are if you like if you take a scarlet figure and wipe off all the paint.
Yeah,
interesting.
Yeah, you know, so yeah, but you know the process, the injection molding process has become a lot better.
Yeah,
so they can get a lot more detail. Sure.
Was the sneak peek character like the same generation of new characters? You mentioned every year you would add characters, and this was 1987. G.I. Joe had been around for a couple of years already. Was that the same generation as Crystal Ball, like the same batch of new characters?
No, I think it was a bit later.
And did you do anything besides take Owen's name, or was there anything about his interests or personality that you added to that character?
I decided to give him a shout out.
Just a little Easter egg. Yeah, you mentioned that you read a lot of King stuff. Is there a particular Stephen King world that you're like, you know what, I could really add on to this in say as a short story or as a comic series or something? Is there anything that like really grabbed you that you're like, man, yeah, this would be a really fun world to play in?
Well, The Stand.
Oh, wow. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
What would you do with The Stand?
The great thing about The Stand is there's a whole, you know, globe of stories that went on, and we only, you know, as big as that book is with as many characters as that is, there's still,
you could do untold tales of The Stand for like 100 years and not run out of stuff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which they're doing. There's a short story collection coming out that King was very hesitant to agree to let happen, by the way, to let people come and play in that sandbox, I guess. But I think he ultimately loved the idea. So they have a bunch of great writers coming in and each providing a short story that takes place some place in that world. Yeah, I can imagine. I know there was a Marvel
series.
They've
done that for a number of things. They, mm-hmm. you know, I think. At Marvel, they printed a book that was a lot of different artists' takes on Akira's world.
Yeah.
I think I did an 8-page story for that.
Yeah. Nice.
I think it's a nice concept to expand on the universes. Mm-hmm. But that's all, but fanfic is all about that.
Yeah. It is, but you're a professional fanfic if you're doing that. So,
but that's like toys, right? You're given the world, the premise, some characters, and then you create your own thing and run with it. That's part of the fun.
Well, that is the fun, is mm-hmm. you know, creating the world and the rules that bind it.
Are you aware of the G.I. Joe references in King's own work?
No.
So in the Tommyknockers, which came out in 87, he shouts out G.I. Joe. There's a section there, two boys. I don't know, have you ever read the Tommyknockers?
No, I never read the Tommyknockers.
That's all right. That's one you don't have to.
Some people don't like it, but it's a woman finds a crashed UFO, crashed during prehistoric times, buried, embedded in the earth in their small main town, and it begins radiating out this sort of it's sort of an Invasion of the Body Snatchers type story. Wow. And two little boys become infected by this alien knowledge, and one creates a little magic trick that ends up transporting his brother to another dimension. Mm-hmm. And he panics after his brother disappears, and it says, when David got back, Hilly would fall down on his knees and hug David and tell David he could have all the G.I. Joe guys, except maybe for Snake Eyes and Crystal Ball, for a whole week. And then, so this is the bargain this kid makes with the universe.
Did,
is bring my brother back.
Besides Snake Eyes and Crystal Ball?
Says he can have all the G.I. Joes except for Snake Eyes and Crystal Ball.
That's brilliant.
And then in the end of the book, a little spoiler, the boy comes back and he says, Hilly says to him, we got to trade G.I. Joes tomorrow. And his brother says, why? He goes, I don't know, but we got to. I promised. When? I don't know. And the brother who's returned says, as long as I get Crystal Ball, David said, settling himself more firmly into the crook of Hilly's arm. Well, okay, his brother says. So that's G.I. Joe getting a shout out in the Tommyknockers.
I got to read it.
Yeah, and plug in that crystal ball. Yep.
I added the, I bought a little crystal ball, one of the originals off of eBay after I did that story. And I wondered, does this conjure any memories? Did you have
he's
to,
just,
I know you
he's
said.
Complete, huh? And he's got his thumbs.
Got his little shield. He's got his thumbs. He's not been chewed by a dog or a little brother.
The O-rings haven't rotted away.
He's still held together. Did you have to do any embroidery off of what you got from Owen, or was it just sort of this? He knew what the look was. I assume there had to be something that you did to just sort of add.
Well,
it
no,
and
I, think,
it complete
I think
it.
The, I think I think Ron Rudat did mm-hmm. the actual final design.
Mm-hmm.
For the figure. When I do embroider, I don't, a lot of times it's not written down, it's just mm-hmm. sort of in my head.
Yeah. And you're wearing, we should say for the people who are just listening to this, you're wearing the USS flag hat, which was an iconic toy, a massive toy, which I only knew a few kids lucky enough to have that. Would you create vehicles as well, or were you strictly the humans and monsters of G.I. Joe?
Well, I never really created a G.I. Joe vehicle. I used real military vehicles, but the flag, you know, I've had Navy veterans, you know, come up to me and say, "We got 99 flat tops." And say, "No, this one's a very small one."
Very small, but it was big as a toy, man. You had to have a living room that would fit the USS flag.
I want to just while you're talking about the flag, I might be dumb about this, but it doesn't escape me on the Stephen King podcast that it's called the USS flag with two G's, and Randall flag is spelled with two G's. And I mean, listen, G.I. Joe flag, I get it, but the two
Great
G's
connection.
Makes me go. Maybe there's a little connection there. Is there
is there a Randall Flag
nod in USS Flag?
No, General Flag. He was the original commander.
Oh, okay. He was.
See, that's where I was like, I might come off as really stupid here because I don't know. I don't know the entire history of
this. Well, I wonder, was General Flag, you know, the Randall Flag was of course, the sort of demonic villain of The Stand. Just a coincidence then that those names match up?
Mm. Absolutely, because my reference was a comic strip from the 50s called Dan Flag,
which could very well have been in the back of King's
mind. Use that spelling, FLAGG.
Mm-hmm.
So I embroidered off of that.
Okay.
I thought it was good. It was a good name for a general.
Who knows? King could have gotten it from that. He was a big comics reader as a kid. So it's all cross pollination, right? And creativity.
I know that there's a store in Bangor that he would pass that was like Flag and Sons or something with spelled with two G's.
Well, you know,
that always gets the credit. But
the thing about the Dan Flag strip was that in an early issue of Creepy magazine, Archie Goodwin wrote a story that was based on the guy that did Dan Flag.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, because what he did was he farmed out every aspect of the job to other people and didn't tell the other people.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, like the penciler thought that this guy was like writing it, inking it, lettering it, you know, and you know the inker thought that he was penciling it, writing it, you know, and actually he was like just pocketing the money, you know, and paying these guys, you know, like,
that's work for hire, right?
Yeah. And so it was like a creepy story. So like, you know, by accident, these four guys discover what this guy is doing to them. And they plot this fantastic murder thing.
Yeah.
But in the splash page of the story, they show the actual strip he's working on. And like Dan Flag is like obscured by the fact that it's all ligature. The letters are all connected, so you can't really read it. You know.
Yeah. Interesting.
But people that knew the history knew what that was.
Knew it.
Right.
And maybe Stephen King. I'm sure Stephen King had a complete collection of
creepy
creepies.
In oh yeah, of course, of course. I mean, you're creative. You're creative. You know how it works. It's like there's a million things that you see in your life and that have an impact on you that are rattling around in the brain and as you're coming up with stuff. Like, you know, one thing that I connected with what you were saying was like talking about bringing in influences of the people that you know. But they're not necessarily that. King gets that all the time. There's a story he wrote called Lisi's Story. There's a book called Lisi's Story that is, you read it and you go, oh, he's basing this on himself and Tabitha, specifically Tabitha King, his wife. And you know, and he's like kind of denies it. And he says like, yeah, her sisters are more like Tabby's sisters, you know, directly, but like, no, Lisi's not really Tabby and all that stuff. But I think that, you know, that's kind of like what you're saying. It's just like, you know, she's not your wife, you know, that you put into your work, but it's, you know, but there are elements to it and just kind of this grounded human, you know, that has pieces of this character, and you know, I think that that's all part of the creative process, whether it's a name or, you know, something you take in at 5 years old or just something you see every day, and you know, you use that in your art to make it more relatable to other people.
And the best thing is if people don't realize it right away. I mean, I love the fact that the original Captain Marvel, his look was based on Fred McMurray.
You're right.
Wild.
I remember Lubbers, reading friend. That and going, wait a second, my three sons?
Yeah.
But it's like that whole physical physics property of matter cannot be created or destroyed. I feel like we absorb the world, we process it through, and those who do creative work, they whether it's creating a sculpture or an illustration or writing a story, you're taking the things you know and turning them into the raw materials that become the fiction. I know I relate to what you said about drawing from people you know. Whenever I would write fiction, I always did the same thing. This character is not based on this buddy of mine from back in the day. My friend didn't do these actions, but the personality is similar. Little aspects of them are similar, you know? And that's creativity. I think Elvis Costello said all creativity is made of the broken pieces of somebody else's thrill. Well, Larry, you've been so kind in indulging all our Stephen King questions and our crystal ball questions. Tell us what you're working on now. What's on the horizon for you? What's got you excited? You're still very creative and energized. What's keeping you busy?
I'm still writing G.I. Joe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know.
Every month. I'm still doing, you know, some stories here and there from Marvel. And we're talking to a publisher now about a graphic novel I did with Mark Bright, M.D. Bright, about 4 years ago. It's about superheroes in the future. And I've got a deal with Abrams Publishing to do with three 150-page graphic novels based on a character I created years ago.
Wonderful.
The Fox Princess, which is a pretty much about Japanese fairy tales and takes place in feudal times with sort of funny animal characters.
You got to draw your funny animals now.
I'm not drawing it.
Okay.
I'm writing it. I already plotted the whole thing, and I finished dialogue in the first issue, and I'm working on the second issue dialogue.
You know, it's okay to take a break every once in a while. You know, it's like it's totally fine to rest, kick back.
I'm working on like three other projects also.
You mentioned you're still writing G.I. Joe. What's the difference now in the kind of stories you told 40 years ago versus the kind of stories that interest you about the Joes these days?
It's all the same story.
Mm-hmm. You feel like I'm wondering about you as a storyteller, whether you've changed or whether your interest or focus in how you direct it or how you tell the story is any different. But it's the same?
Yeah, no, I figure I've learned a lot over the years. But I still do it the same way. You know, I've always done the Joe stories by trying to put the Joes in a horrible situation on the first page, mm-hmm. and then figuring out how to get them out of it by the last page. Ergo, I don't know what's on page three until mm-hmm. I get to page two.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and because I literally make the stuff up page by page.
Exactly, and how Stephen King does it too.
That's how he writes.
Yeah.
He does an outline or a plan too far ahead.
I don't even have an outline. I have no mm-hmm. idea. Because I figure that if you know how it ends, it's very difficult to keep from telegraphing that. Mm-hmm. That becomes 90% of your work, is to try to create stuff that doesn't telegraph that ending. So to me, that seemed like an utter waste of effort. You know, why are you like, it's like, you know, trying to run an obstacle course and putting more obstacles in front of mm-hmm. yourself. Like, for instance, in issue number 21 of G.I. Joe, which is the silent.
That's the silent one, right?
Yeah. Where
for
a lot of the origin of Snake Eyes and mm-hmm. Storm Shadow.
Legendary issue.
Yeah. I got to page, I think, 15 or 16, and I wrote and drew the whole thing in 3 days, you know, and I'm, you know, literally drawing it panel by panel,
mm-hmm.
and I get to, like, page 15 or 16, and I realize, oh, I've drawn both the characters, I've got the sleeves torn, mm-hmm. and I said, I could do something with that, like, what if both of these characters had the same tattoo?
Oh, right.
You know, so I said, okay. I went to the I Ching. I had used the I Ching in Iron Fist.
Mm-hmm.
I gave a character, Lei Kung the Thunderer, a hexagram on his chest plate. And I remembered, because I was drawing that issue of Iron Fist, that I had a hard time from panel to panel remembering which hexagram it was, what the order of the lines. I just chosen a random hexagram. So this time I said, okay, I'm going to use a hexagram that's totally symmetrical, an open line on top and a closed line next, and an open line, closed line. And that's what I did. And when I did that, I had no idea why they both had that hexagram.
mm-hmm.
It was just, you know, a cute visual thing.
Yeah, but it connects them. It bonds the hero and the villain.
The cliffhanger was that, why do they have the same tattoo? So it wasn't until, you know, number 26, that I did the origin of Snake Eyes.
Yeah,
and gave up, and that's when I made up the entire Arashikage Ninja Clan and
mm-hmm.
explain why they both had that same tattoo. So,
that's the characters leading you through the story, isn't it?
Yeah.
It is. And mm-hmm. it's also, you know, you have to be able to see these things as you go along. But it's my advantage as a person that, like, who drew first
mm-hmm.
before I started writing, is that I never considered myself a writer. You know, I considered myself a penciler or a word processor, because I don't think of the stories in terms of words.
Mm-hmm.
I visualize the stories in my head as a series of images.
Mm-hmm.
And what? I try to make it so that, you know, you can tell the entire story just by looking at those images, you know, rather than having to read exposition. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's another connection back to King, isn't it, Eric? He's talked about how he'll get an image in his mind and he mm-hmm. won't be sure who this is, who's this character, what is this situation, and then that becomes the little core around which the story crystallizes.
When a writer starts from an image, and that's what's wrong with a lot of comics today, is all these people would be novelists. Just, you know, you have like 10 pages in a row of characters sitting in a room explaining the plot,
mm-hmm.
you know, and my policy was always, well, if they have to explain the plot, they should be doing it while they're hitting each other in the face.
feels like creatively, it feels like an Easter egg hunt to me when you're describing this, where it's like you're doing this, and this is what the joy of creativity is. It's like you're discovering this in the same way that whoever's reading the comic, or in King's case, reading the book, would discover it too. It's like, and maybe that's why, you know, King has that ability to like keep you turning pages, because he's discovering along with
King, because like I can really actually see the things he's describing.
Yeah, 100%. Such a great.
Yeah, and that's a huge important thing. There's a lot of writers that, you know, you can be sort of memorized by the poetry, by the words, but they're not creating any image in your mind.
Yeah.
You know, of something solid that you can latch onto.
It's almost like a not telekinesis, but what's the
projection or something.
Telepathic.
Yeah.
Oh, it's like Crystal Ball. He's hypnosis. It hypnotizes you and makes you see things that aren't there and aren't real.
Yeah, but you know, like all my favorite writers are like that. You know, like Cormac McCarthy, you know, conjures up these incredible images. I was reading Blood Meridian.
Mm-hmm.
I came to the chapter where this character is sitting at the campfire, and you know, this guy comes from behind them and like swaps his head off with a giant Bowie knife. The head rolls into the fire. But you know, the language of it was like so Melville that I immediately picked up the phone and I called Michael Kaluta and I read him the whole chapter.
Wow. I remember from Meridian, he looks off at the horizon and sees purple mountains like floating temples, floating footless in the void. And that's great imagery. Yeah,
he really puts those images, you know, into your head. You could, if you look at the Ethan brothers, the Coen brothers, No Country for Old Men.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, you could tell that they saw those images in the prose.
Yeah. And I think the best Stephen King adaptations get that too. And there's a reason why Stephen King has such a huge amount of work that people want to bring to the screen. And I think it's because you can't help, especially if you're a creative person, you can't help but have that imagination fire reading his stuff. And you see it and you want to then go, I want to see it big. I want to make that big for people, you know? Yeah.
Larry, before we let you go, I know you've probably answered this 10,000 times, but I'm very curious, your favorite G.I. Joe hero and favorite villain. And does it ever change?
Snake Eyes and Destro.
Snake Eyes and Destro.
I see endless possibilities in those characters.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The choice to make Snake Eyes silent, was that yours?
Pretty much. Because, the inspiration was the fact that they explained to me why he's all in black.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, you know, that's the color of the plastic. There's no paint outside.
Oh, really? Is that what it was? Is he's all black?
It's a tremendous cost-cutting thing. If you have a character that's all black or all white, you know, you skip a whole manufacturing step.
Mm-hmm. And you made his personality sort of all black, like opaque. We don't really know why he doesn't.
I originally wanted him to be that vague that any kid could identify.
And Destro, I was always intrigued by, is his face metal? Is it a mask? What is it?
See, to me, I've always, whenever I've drawn Destro, I've drawn it as a solid mask. It's a steel mask.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't move it.
Right. It lifts the movements up.
I think it was Michael Golden that started, you know, putting expressions on the face when he did the yearbook.
Mm. And the cartoon, of course, had him talking and, you know, expressing. I always wondered, like, is it just like a, you know, your brain, as a kid, you try to come up with solutions rather, like adults go, oh, that doesn't make any sense. But kids go, well, maybe it's like a nanotechnology that just grafts to his skin.
It's like Dr. Doom.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
you know, you don't expect that square thing that it's his mouth to like start moving.
in the best versions, it doesn't, for sure. I mean, it was kind of like Spider-Man's eyes, you know, sometimes, you know, the people use them for expression, but it's like in reality, and especially in the early days, it was just a mask. Yeah, sure. But still, they would sometimes the eyes would go wider when they wanted more expressiveness. Sometimes they'd go smaller. And then, the MCU figured out, I guess it's all, you know, Tony Stark tech or whatever for all that stuff. But I think for kids, like they either don't care or like Anthony said, they make up their own reasons why, you know, why it's moving like that or, you know, whatever.
No, it's all about, you will accept anything as long as you like it.
Yeah. Right. That's true.
That is true. Well, Larry, I hope you get a chance to cross paths with Owen King at one of these conventions. I bet you guys would have a lot to talk about. Thank you for sharing your memories of working on G.I. Joe and Crystal Ball and geeking out on Stephen King with us. It's been a real pleasure having you here. You're a legend, and you gave kids like me and generations after a lot of happy memories. So thank you, sir.
Well, thank you.
Many thanks to Larry Hama for joining us for this lively and quite different chat for the show. It's always fun to talk with folks who have creatively collaborated with Stephen King, and Larry had a particularly unique interaction with the man, as well as, you know, a huge impact on children of a certain age. I hesitate to call us old because I don't want to call myself old, but he had a huge impact on kids from my generation. Our next show drops on May 7th. And is with an up-and-coming writer-director who has a new film coming out. It's a horror flick called The Surrender. Premiered at South by Southwest, Shudder is putting it out at the end of May. Her name is Julia Max, and she's bringing Rose Red to the table. That's King's 2002 ABC miniseries that is more than a little bit inspired by Shirley Jackson's The Haunting of Hill House. It's a great chat. She was wonderful. Look, we get a little deep. We talk a lot about death. It gets a little bit cerebral, but we also have a lot of fun talking about some of the more ridiculous places that Rose Red goes. All right, what else? Don't forget to sign up for KingCast Patreon. It's the best way to support the show. And you get a ton of never released in the main feed episodes, commentaries, and all sorts of shenanigans dating back 5 years now. Damn. Patreon.com/TheKingCast. Sign up, throw us a few bucks. We'll make it worth your while. And that should do it. We'll see you May 7th. Adios, folks. The KingCast is hosted by Eric Vespi, that's me, and Anthony Bresnikan. The show is produced by myself as well as Abby Goel and Tara Ansley, and is distributed by the Fangoria Podcast Network. Daniel Danger is our art director, and the show was created by me, the late, great Scott Wampler.